This talk was given by Chris Udo Abram at the Zen Center of New York City. Udo is a senior lay student in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org/zcnyc. Thank you for listening.
So I started my Zen training in residence at the monastery upstate. There, all the residents live together, we work together, sit together, eat together, and you give up a lot of control of your environment. You don't get a choice of who you'll work with or who you'll sit next to, what you'll eat for lunch, when you go to sleep, and there are very few distractions, and there's no easy access to the internet. When I was there, there was one payphone on the wall in the sort of public space, and there was just one computer in the office that you could access the internet. And so all of our interactions happened face to face with the other residents, and there was nowhere to hide. You'd have to keep showing up day after day, no matter how you're feeling. There was not even some of the new buildings there were not even built yet, so it was just, you're all just kind of like together. And if you had a problem with someone, you had to deal with it. They would be there the day after and the day after that. And I had very little awareness of global news or national news, because it didn't seem all that relevant. You know, we were all just living together there, and that seemed to fill the whole world. And over the months and years, the relationships with the other residents started to feel like family. And I assume those conditions are typical for religious communities for, you know, hundreds of years. So fast forwarding 20 years to the present, and my life is somewhat quite different. Now I'm what people call a digital nomad. And I live in Thailand mostly, but I travel between cities and spend time in Bangkok, Chiang Mai, also in Jakarta, Kyoto. I have a job working for a company that's entirely remote. Most of the conversations are asynchronous, and I often don't know where my colleagues are, and they don't necessarily know where I am physically. The work I do building websites is seen mostly by people I'll never meet. Most of the active personal relationships in my life are not with people physically present. They're, you know, people in New York and Bali and Vancouver. And so there's no single physical place that, for me, that can be considered home. For my Zen training, I do Daisan with a teacher on Zoom. And I also have a therapist I meet on Zoom. So because of all this, having a physical home seems sort of less important, because no matter where I am, I still have the same access to my work, my relationships, my teachers. Additionally, I use various social platforms to connect with communities and people in wherever I am. So things like Facebook and Meetup and all that kind of stuff. And now I'm now much more interested in global news, national news, and often not in touch with the sort of local news. And so it's almost like my life somehow exists or to a large extent in the cloud. And when I do touch down in physical communities, it's often facilitated by some kind of cloud-based technology. So this couldn't be more different than how I described my life in residence at the monastery. And I'm not saying that everyone's going through a similar trajectory, but perhaps my life is an example of a general trend in society as more and more things move to sort of a digital mediated platform. And we're sort of less grounded in our physical bodies and rely more on these digital platforms for our everyday activity and connection. So in a recent study, it was found that only half of Americans say they have meaningful face-to-face social interactions on a daily basis. And the pandemic sort of expedited this trend. Now many people who went remote during the pandemic don't want to return to the office. So my question for us, but also for myself, was how does Zen practice address the particular challenges that we have because of this kind of radically different way of living and relating and being that we suddenly are doing these days? I think it's important for us to really understand these new technologies and the ways they change our realities. And we can understand the benefits they bring, but also the problems they create, both on a personal level and a societal level. In a recent interview, Esther Perel, who's a psychotherapist, made some comments and observations about relationships, our relationships in today's society. And she says, technology is changing our expectations of intimacy, and we forget what real intimacy can be because we get adjusted to a lower level of experience of relationship online, and we call that good intimacy. Digitally facilitated connections are lowering our competence in intimacy with humans. It makes us less able to be with people who challenge us and less able to cope with the sort of messiness of life. Technology flattens relationships and removes life from them. Real life meetings are embodied. You experience the other person through the senses. So we're becoming de-skilled at being uncomfortable. And we're less prepared for true relationships. And what we're left with is this modern form of loneliness, which, you know, we often think we're super connected to so many things through our social platforms and stuff. But, you know, at the root, there's a kind of loneliness and alienation. And as a society, our daily use of technology is only growing. The average American now spends 4.5 hours a day staring at their phone. And young people, specifically the teenagers, spend 5 hours a day just on social media. And if you add in other things like video games, then they're up to 7 to 10 hours a day on average. So while a lot of us here might have had play-based childhoods, where we go out and play every day, this new generation is having a phone-based childhood, where that's their main activity. And as you can imagine, this isn't compatible with healthy human development. And so we're finding we've created this new generation of young adults whose brains have developed within this social media loops, and they're now finding themselves unable to cope with the social complexities of modern work environments. There's another person called Tristan Harris, who's the co-founder of the Center for Humane Technology, and he's got some really great talks on this. He describes how social media platforms are designed to fight for our attention in what he calls an extractive attention economy. And so, given that our brains and emotions haven't changed or developed in 1,000 years, they're not prepared for the kind of stimulus, constant stimulation that they're now getting. And I'm sure you know this, but the type of content that is really able to grab our attention is the kind of crazy stuff you see online, the negative content, the stuff that makes you angry. And so the algorithms promote this content. There is a recent MIT study that found that fake news spreads on Twitter, on X, 6 times faster than something that's true. And so we're getting the emergence of these online communities that believe in various 9/11 conspiracy theories or flat earthism, and you name it. And so we have a whole slew of new problems in society caused by social media. Tech addiction, political polarization, election manipulation, outrageification, radicalization, vanification, sexual predation and sextortion, and mental health issues like anxiety and depression. And over time, this is leading to what Tristan Harris calls a human downgrading. And so as a society, our attention spans are, you know, downgrading. Our relationships are downgraded. Our communities are downgraded. Our civility, our decency is downgraded. And I would add, our ability to appreciate our life is being downgraded. So this human downgrading is being called the global climate change of culture. And like climate change, it may be catastrophic. And so we're finding it harder and harder to agree on anything. There's Yuval Harari, the famous philosopher, author, has a quote where he says, countries like the United States have the most powerful information technology in history. And yet Americans are unable to agree on who won the last election, on whether vaccines help us, and some even question if climate change is real. So how is it that a society with such powerful information technology seems unable to agree on the most basic matters? So beyond social media, there are other technologies that can be pointed to as a cause of kind of like a dumbing down of our minds. We no longer need to remember things in the same way because we have everything on our phones. We don't need much physical awareness to get around the city because we have Google Maps. And so we're not exercising our brains as a society in the same way. And so even though in the 20th century, the IQ of the average person rose 30 points because of advances in education, technology, nutrition. But since the turn of the millennium, there's now actually been a decline of the average IQ by 2 to 4 points. So in general, technology is saying to us, you don't have to know, I will know for you. And it sort of neutralizes the unknown, or tries to. But instead of us being more relaxed, we're finding ourselves more filled with self-doubt and more anxious. So somehow we've created an environment where the next generation is going to be not as smart and as capable as the current one. And yet we're leaving in our wake a host of problems they're going to be less capable of solving, such as inequality, nuclear proliferation. So just to touch on a few other technologies before we move on. But there's the new Apple Vision Pro, which, you know, you wear on your face, and it creates even larger boundaries between each other. So we're having trouble agreeing on just what's a true idea, what's true in the world. And now we may have trouble agreeing on what's even real in the physical reality. And with the Apple Vision Pro, for example, you know, it can add things to your reality, but it can also delete them. So, you know, if you're on a crowded bus, you can program it to make it look like you're in the park, or you're on a jumbo jet or something. But when it gets good enough to be able to delete things like homeless people or pride flags or anything that you find uncomfortable, then it, you know, it takes on a whole new level of power. And so also we have AI, which we can hand over more and more of our thinking to. And soon enough, we'll each have AI agents, which will take care of a large part of our lives. And for all their benefits, this AI is exacerbating some of the problems mentioned. So it's damaging our democratic systems because, you know, our democracy relies on the free exchange of ideas. And if you can hook up AIs to that, they can create, you know, much more compelling ideas and propaganda and speeches. And so there can be, you know, potentially an arms race between political parties as to who can harness AI the best to create the most compelling, you know, messaging. ChatGPT, OpenAI is already having to police ChatGPT from foreign groups who are using it to influence the US elections. So now, as these machines are surpassing our own intelligence, things are only going to speed up and get, you know, even more wild. So I started this talk with a description of how my life has changed, and then described how society has changed in these last 20 years. And so where does that leave us as Zen practitioners? So first, as in any other time, we need to meet the world as it is. We meet the world on its terms, not ours. It can be tempting to run for the hills, like a Luddite, to go to a cave in Tibet or something. But that isn't our way in Zen. That's not the freedom we are after. Zen teaches us how to find freedom wherever we are, whatever the circumstances. And the best place to start is right with what's in front of us. They have the path of the Zen practitioner is often described in 10 Oxfording pictures. And the 10th picture shows the great sage coming down off the mountain into the marketplace and mixing with the people. And yet in our practice, we don't wait until we're enlightened to do that. We, especially as lay practitioners, we do it every time we walk out the door. We do it every time we turn on our phones. That becomes our practice. And so this means we need to educate ourselves about these technologies. We have to become skillful in our use of them. So yes, social media addiction is terrible, but social media can also be used for good things. If we are to be bodhisattvas in this world, we need to go to the places where people are suffering. That's in the physical realms or the digital realms. We need to talk their language and meet their minds. I'm a big fan of Miyotai Sensei. She was the first abbess here back in 2001. And for the past several years, she's had quite a prominent presence on Facebook. And she posts, you know, a couple times a week about her life, about her pets. Just typical stuff. So here's an example. She says, "The doorbell rings. I stand up and start heading that way. The cat runs between my legs, ready to run down the basement stairs. Then he changes his mind, heading towards the kitchen. And then he decides to dart towards the hallway. On the third pass through my legs, we tangled up and I tumble, splayed out on the wood floor, hollering to the hills. I did not go down the stairs, yay. The porch painter, who, of course, was freaked out by my yelling, seems to have recovered. R dashed around delivering Tylenol ice packs, and Abby kissed my nose and gave me a lassie look deep into my Timmy-down-the-well eyes. I checked Mr. Chickabee, nose to tail, and nothing seems hurt. I'm contemplating murdering him, but that, as we know, is just bad cat karma." So I imagine, like most of you, our Facebook feeds are full of, you know, various things, but including sort of vanity and insecurity and anger. So to have Miyotai's posts just appear in the middle of all of that has an unusual amount of power. And she writes in the style of the medium. She's often saying something about her life, her dog, her cat, very similar to what others post. But it's Miyotai, and so there's a certain poetry to it. There's a sort of humor and generosity and something unexpectedly kind of wonderful about it. So to some degree, yes, we need to learn how to swim within these new technologies. They're kind of unavoidable. And yet, of course, we should be wary. These social media platforms are not neutral. They don't have our best interest in mind. They are designed for engagement, and they'll do everything they can to win our attention and keep it. And digital communication, Zoom, whatever, is disembodied. It doesn't seem to nourish us as much as in-person meeting. And so we should listen to our bodies and minds and use our practice to take care of ourselves and know when and how to disengage. And if we look at what we do here or what we do at the monastery, when we come to session, there's a reason why we turn off our digital devices and we return to a very natural, basic human rhythm. There's a reason, you know, when we sit zazen, we find a quiet room. So there's an inherent sufficiency to our life and practice in its most basic form. And if we've forgotten this, which we can easily do, as we practice, we remember again. You know, it becomes evident again. So we should not be deceived into thinking we need anything else. There's no meditation app or biofeedback technology that will help us realize our true nature. We already have everything we need. And to me, it's kind of amazing that as we develop these more and more advanced technologies to manage, you know, every bit of our bodies and minds and track everything, that it seems to me at least that none of it is of any use in helping us find real peace. There's no set of supplements that will help us live forever. There's no virtual reality playground, which will be a permanent heaven realm. There's no combination of ice baths or saunas that will stop us from getting triggered. And if we overindulge in any of these new activities and technologies, we will find eventually we find ourselves getting sick. Speaking from experience. And so we may need to be reminded of that over and over again, just by, you know, trying things out. And so we do need to take care of ourselves. And it can seem that with all these new challenges, that the odds are really stacked against us as Zen practitioners. And it's likely that every generation thought that, you know, when ever anything new came out. But there's no reason to be afraid. We actually do have a tool set here that is perfectly designed to address these challenges. And of course, first we have Zazen, which is our, you know, root practice. And Zazen develops our awareness and concentration. And so it can help counteract any, you know, deterioration of our minds because of use of technology. Zazen also makes us more sensitive to the mind state itself. So we can become more tuned to recognize the activities that are not nourishing for us, that are causing us to suffer. And so we can make better choices. Our bad habits become more evident when we are sitting zazen. They're harder to tolerate, and so there's more of an imperative to let go of them. Zazen helps us to uncover the part of ourselves that wants to live, that wants to be free, that wants an authentic life. And the more we practice, the more we align with that desire, and the harder it is to go astray. And ultimately, Zazen provides us insight into the nature of who we are, the fundamental nature. And when we're clear on who we are, then the various hooks that these technologies, that social media tries to use to manipulate us, will simply not work. Since we no longer invest in our sense of self, we can see clearly that we are never lacking anything to begin with. And not lacking anything, there's nothing we need from the outside. And so we will hold ourselves more lightly, hold our identities, our desires, our grudges, not quite as, personally. And so we'll be able to walk through dangerous realms without being in danger. And so you can see this modern world with all its barbs and hooks and bells and whistles as sort of an advanced training ground for us as Zen practitioners. But when we're clear on who we are, then there is no problem. So beyond Zazen, as we did earlier this morning, we have liturgy, chanting, invocation, dedication. And that's a very explicit channeling of our energy to a particular state of mind, a particular outcome. It's an expression of our true nature and the true understanding of things. And so when we have a daily liturgy practice, it tunes us and helps us to move in harmony with the world. And then instead of being enraged and triggered by things, we can meet the world and ourselves with more acceptance and compassion, because that's what we've been practicing. In our tradition, in our training matrix, we have other practices, such as what we call body practice, which are things like yoga or tai chi, which are taken up in a very deliberate way of being intimate with the body. And this helps us to return and touch in with the wisdom of our sensory bodies. And I think with so much going online, sort of leaving the body behind, we are cutting off ourselves from that wisdom. And so body practice, taking up a body practice, can help keep us grounded and connected. And then, of course, here we have our teachers. We have our teachings, our moral and ethical teachings. We have the sutras and other practices that support us and equip us for exactly the challenges we face. And of course, we have the Sangha. We have each other. And when we come together and practice together, either here or in residence at the monastery, or we do session together, we meet each other's bodies and minds. We become intimate in a way with each other, both our strengths and our blind spots. And it sometimes seems you have to not only practice your own mind, but you have to practice the minds of others. And this was certainly, for me, at the beginning, especially really challenging. I didn't really see why we had to do that. It seemed to really just get in the way. But certainly, as I went on, it turned into, the Sangha turns into this source of richness and inspiration and companionship along the way. So I don't know any substitute for physically practicing together with the Sangha for extended periods. It's too easy on these, there's a lot that's gone online. In our order, even, there's many things online, but it's too easy to control the situation and only show up when you're feeling good, or jump out when you're, feeling uncomfortable or whatever. But you can't do that in person. And so you have to find a way to manage, to cope with, to practice your uncomfortableness, your suffering. You have to develop patience. These things are all kind of baked into the way we train together. So, and I found this, having spent 4 years at the monastery, and I also lived in this temple for about 3 years, some years ago. I found that to be very useful in, going into the workforce, work environments, many other situations. So the path, they say the path is always straightforward, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's easy. And this ango, this period of training, was introduced with the theme, going straight on an ever-twisting path. So how do you go straight on a path that's got all these curves and pitfalls and things? And that is actually one of the koans that students here take up in, it's part of the miscellaneous koans. So students sit with that question, not only to resolve it on their cushion, but also to know how to resolve it in their lives. And how to resolve it, you know, within all the kind of activity, all these new technological developments, and all these new challenges in our lives. So how do you be a true person in this world that is so confused, distracted, and unwell? And the trick is just don't separate from it. Don't separate from the struggle. Don't comment on it. Don't judge it. Just be intimate with it. Just be the struggle. And then there is no problem. When we are stuck, just be stuck. When we feel lousy, just feel lousy. When we feel excited or angry or lonely, or we're craving some kind of stimulation, anything just to tell us we matter. Just be these things. Be who you are in that moment. Don't add anything else. And just keep putting one foot in front of the other. So we can indeed go straight, no matter how many paths, no matter how many twists and turns our path may have, no matter what life may throw at us. Some people call this the Dharma ending age. There's sort of a legend around the arc of the Dharma, how it's developed over centuries. And some people say this is a Dharma ending age. It may in fact die out during these decades. And that's fine. When we don't step back, then there's no problem. In Genjo Koan Dogen, the Japanese Zen master says, a fish swims in the ocean, and no matter how far it swims, there's no end to the water. A bird flies in the sky, and no matter how far it flies, there's no end to the air. However, the fish and the bird have never left their elements. When their activity is large, their field is large. When their need is small, their field is small. Thus, each of them totally covers its full range, and each of them totally experiences its realm. If the bird leaves the air, it will die at once. If the fish leaves the water, it will die at once. Know that the water is life and air is life. The bird is life and the fish is life. Life must be the bird. Life must be the fish. And so here is the place. Here the way unfolds. The boundary of realization is not distinct, for the realization comes forth simultaneously with the mastery of Buddha Dharma. So when I reflect more personally on my own life and my own path and style of living, I'm pretty sure I've made choices along the way that were not necessarily good for me. I've sometimes chosen comfort over growth, sometimes smallness over generosity. And these choices were made out of my own confusion. And these various advances in technologies have, in some ways, been an enabler. I've often had this illusion that they provide control and power, and bought into that and made decisions based on that. But I've often been led to loneliness and alienation. But wherever I may go, I try to keep returning to this practice. I think sometimes we need to take certain wrong paths in our life. We need to try things out. We need to explore. We all have our own personal karma, and it takes time to exhaust that. I do my best to be honest with what I'm experiencing and with where my life is going. I try to make the right decisions and I ask for help. And I do have faith in this Dharma, in this teaching. It becomes more and more clear that this is what the world so desperately needs. You know, something that is fundamentally true. And just to add, before finishing, that we Buddhists are not the only ones that are concerned with the state of society, the state of technology. There are many others concerned about this, that are fighting for this, just like some years ago there was a fight against smoking, you know, once people started to wake up to the fact that it was damaging ourselves. So there are whistleblowers in companies, there are regulatory policy that's passing through governments. There's the Center for Humane Technology, there's the Strother School of Radical Attention, who are these organizations that have started to bring awareness and work towards policies that are going to be more healthy for society. And we were making progress. There was a recent New York Times survey that found that many young people do know about the negative effects of social media. And it said actually almost half of them wish that platforms like X and TikTok were never invented. And yet they are still hooked on them. Eight states recently adopted measures this year to eliminate cell phones from schools. There's a new bill called the Kids Online Safety Act that is currently going through Congress, which will make social media apps a lot more safe for kids. And also the technology companies are having to be more proactive with this. They, you know, releasing these screen time apps that are telling us how long we've been using our phone each day. So we Zen Buddhists are not alone in our desire for what is good, for what is wholesome, for what is real. And this goodness is our basic human nature. No matter how twisted things may seem in the world, in our lives, in our minds, this basic goodness is always present. We can never stray from it. We use our practice to become convinced of that, to learn how to access it, to no longer be fooled by our minds. So I'll just end with a quote from Arundhati Roy, who I don't know much about, but it came up in my came up in my Facebook feed. She's an Indian author and activist. So I read a bit about her on Wikipedia. Still don't know much about her. So anyway, it's a nice quote. She says, "To love, to be loved, to never forget your own insignificance, to never get used to the unspeakable violence and the vulgar disparity of life around you, to seek joy in the saddest places, to pursue beauty to its lair, to never simplify what is complicated or complicate what is simple, to respect strength, never power, and above all, to watch, to try and understand, to never look away, and never, never to forget."
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as cushions, incense, liturgical instruments, Dharma books, and more, visit monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.